Live event coverage on RadioSt.Pete.com from the St. Petersburg Clearwater Marriott. Today's Suncoast Tiger Bay Club Luncheon, a legislative update, members of the state legislature. Todd Jennings is club president.
At this time, I'd like to introduce our moderator this afternoon, founder of St. Peter's Blog of Florida Politics, Peter Schorsch.
Good afternoon, Tigers. It is my privilege to be with you again, moderating this year's legislative panel. I was trying to think about the legislative session, which only ended on Monday. I'm sure these guys and gals are just a wee bit tired. I know Senator Labella has been putting in extra hours as the chair of the Appropriations Committee. And so this whole legislative wrap-up that we're doing right now kind of feels like a little bit of a legislative check-in. It is almost without a doubt that they will be back in Tallahassee, maybe by Memorial Day. A memorandum actually just went out about 20 minutes ago from the Senate President talking about medical marijuana. There is an intense call for them to go back and address medical marijuana. It is likely, and we will hear from them what they think the likelihood is, that Governor Scott is going to fillet the budget, and there's talk about overriding that and so forth. And so I think one of the themes is, this is the show that goes all year long. They will actually be back in January. They will be back in committee weeks in September. It's the smallest gap between two legislative sessions that we've ever had. And playing against all that, as we saw yesterday, Adam Putnam launched for governor. Gwen Graham launched last week for governor. We have the 2018 campaign cycle, which will be the busiest in Florida's history. So politics is a show that never stops. I'm going to let them introduce themselves with a question. I'm going to give them 1 minute and 30 seconds. Their answers can be 1 minute and 30 seconds. I'm going to reserve the right to do follow-up. Your questions will then follow. I want to get to as many questions as possible. I think those of you who have attended previous panels or previous programs that I've moderated, I reserve the right to cut you off at the knees, Tim Gillespie, if you start speechifying instead of asking a question. And then we will do a lightning round at the end to get some very quick answers to some hot-button questions that I have for the lawmakers. So we'll save 5 or 6 minutes at the end. So without further ado, I do want to point out that there are some members of the delegation not here. I know that some people are still catching up, Larry Ahern, et cetera. Thank you to the five that attended. Chris Labella just came back from a funeral for Representative Diamond's father. So I don't want you guys to go easy on them. But they're a little battle here. So I'm going to start off with a little bit of a softball. A minute 30. Give me what you are most proud of out of the 2017 legislative session. And I'll start down there with Representative Labella.
Thank you very much. what I'm most proud of is it would have been a bill that would have passed. Unfortunately, it failed on the last night of session, and that was a bill that would have helped PTSD and those suffering from TBI to have a designation on a Florida ID card with a disability designation, which they currently do not have. I guess it would either be the cosmetic manufacturing bill I passed or the Schools of Hope bill that I was one of the main sponsors of.
Thank you. Representative Peters.
Thank you, Peter. The one thing that I'm probably the most proud of this year is some of the environmental stuff, and it's local stuff that
can
we
speak
did.
Speak up a little.
Is it not working?
Take it out. Just take it out.
Take it out? Is that better? Okay, so that's better.
Hi.
Thank you.
Much better. Now you can really hear me.
I think what I'm most proud of this year about is environmental stuff. You know, it was very frustrating last year with the sewer spillages and overflows throughout the county, and it was very disheartening when DEP came to one of our delegation meetings and said that all the sewer spillage, all the sewer overflows in the state of Florida, Pinellas County accounted for more than 50%, and that's disheartening. And so this year, we did a pollution notification so that anyone that does have any kind of pollution spill, they must report it within 24 hours. And I think that's really important because the public needs to know. So that's one of them. And then some local projects, us be able to bring home some money to help St. Pete Beach fix their sewers and to help some folks in Tierra Verde with Shell Key being closed off and so, some of the environmental stuff that we did this year that I think I'm most proud of.
Thank you. All right, Brookie.
Thank you. I think the most thing I was proud of was one of my colleagues, Mr. Ben Diamond, and the hard work that he did. And I would like, if you would, to join me in a moment of silence for his father. His father, Dr. Diamond, I met when my son was 8 years old. He was diagnosed with juvenile diabetes, and the first time I met Dr. Diamond was in All Children's Hospital, and I've known him ever since. And it's a pleasure to serve with his son. So if you would join me in a moment of silence and recognition of Representative Ben Diamond's father, Frank, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Tigers. I love coming to Tiger Bay. I'm most proud of three things. One, the Dozier bill. For the first time, this state apologized to the 400 to 500 men who are still living. Thank you. Dr. Kimberly has unearthed 55 bodies, 24 more than what was reported, and I was able to tie an appropriation to that of $1.4 million. Which will do a memorial and help to reinter those bodies. Secondly, we renamed 375, the ramp that leads you down by the Coliseum in St. Petersburg, see Bett-Wimbush Highway. Bett-Wimbush was the first African-American to serve on the City Council of St. Pete, became vice mayor, was tapped by Governor Askew to be assistant secretary in the old Department of Commerce, and she was the first Black female lawyer to set up shop in the city of St. Petersburg and has been prolific in her public service. And lastly, you might not think this very much, but I am most proud of my seat on the floor of the Senate, which was next to the master of the Senate, Jack Lotvalley. I got a chance to watch this senator operate. And it was a learning experience. And Jack, thank you for helping me with Gulfport. We had $127,000 in the budget to help Gulfport with their sewer lateral line replacement to honor the work that they've done. And Jack helped me with that appropriation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Senator Roussan, I'm happy to be your mentor in the Senate. I just wish you'd start voting right. I think the my major highlights on the positive side of the session were really three things. First of all, my highest priority in the budget was to try to get a raise for our state employees. Our state employees have had but one raise in 12 or 13 years. It wasn't a big one this year, but at least it was an across-the-board raise. Our law enforcement, our correction officers, judges, state attorneys, public defenders got a bigger percentage raise. We need to ensure that our public employees are high quality, and we've got to pay people if we want to keep them. Second thing was we spent about twice as much as we did last year on beach renourishment. Beaches are very important to our economic development in Florida and, our tourism industry and so forth. And I can't remember what the third one was.
Thank you, Rick Perry. That's just the banter we have. Keep the microphone for a second, Senator Landau. Just a quick follow-up. What was one thing, as appropriations chair, you would have liked to have seen either better funded or funded at all that did not make its way into the budget?
Well, I would rather have seen our public schools funded better. It's really sad after being in the Senate for 15 years, and this is my opportunity to be the budget chairman in the Senate, to not be able to do more for our public schools. The problem is the allocations process. The budget chairman can only spend what the presiding officers agreed for each silo of the budget, and they only agreed to a set amount. The required local effort, which has been good enough in Florida for all these years as part of the state's effort that would go up with the rising property rates, good enough until the year before last, but all of a sudden now it's a tax increase, meant $500 million that could have gone into schools that didn't. And that was the difference between a significant increase and basically it being flat as it was this year. The statements that you may hear regarding education funding going up include all the special funding for all of Speaker Corcoran's priorities, charter schools, schools of hope, and so forth. Not going to public K-12 schools.
I'm going to start with Representative Peters and then rotate all the way back down. If you were Governor Rick Scott, would you sign the budget, line item veto the budget, or veto the budget in its entirety?
Well, thank you for that question, Peter. If I were Rick Scott, I think it would be very difficult to veto the entire budget. But I'll tell you, I'm very disappointed in some things that weren't put in that budget, and so I've got some heartburn on that, and I almost want to see him veto the budget, but I think that would be challenging, and I don't think that in the end it would be the best for Floridians. So I think if I were him, there were some things that went on this year that I think weren't very transparent. And so I think those things I would probably go in just out of principle because of the process that was done, and it wasn't out in the open. I think if I were Rick Scott, I would go in with a scalpel, and I would take that veto pen, and I would carve out things that I thought were put in the budget that shouldn't have been put in the budget, or were put in the budget that weren't done and open in the sunshine, and things that maybe pet projects that were strictly political and not for the best of the people. I think those are the things that I would veto.
Representative Duke.
Well, Rick Scott will never look this good, but I would use the line item tool that they have for the being able to line item things that are not germane to the greater good of the entire state or the people who actually pay the money. But I wouldn't use a scalpel. I would probably use a chainsaw.
Senator Roussan?
Oops, go down.
Yeah.
I think I would encourage him to use the line item veto, but to call us back as soon as possible in the special session to deal with workers' comp, medical marijuana, and not leave those hanging this year.
Well, my advice to the governor has been that they need to pick certain segments of the budget and go after that. A lot of the K-12 education funding that I've been critical of was put in a special bill, in the conforming bill. So by vetoing that bill, you get the not only the statutory language, but you get the appropriation. I would veto that bill. I would veto the economic development bill, which the speaker also required us to put the appropriation in for Visit Florida and Enterprise Florida to try to protect other changes he made in those programs. But I would have the courage to veto that too, and bring us all back to Tallahassee and just dare us not to pass an economic bill that addresses adequately the future needs of our state. by vetoing the education bill and maybe the education section of the budget, you'd be in a position where you bring us back up there and you have a dialogue with the speaker about, okay, you want to do things in education, I want to do things in economic development, and let's match it up and figure out what we can do.
That would be used now, right there, Senator's call for a veto on the education bill. Representative Ladbauer. Same question.
If I were the governor, I would do line item vetoes and, you know, sections of the budget if he so desires. When it was passed on Monday, I believe there was four senators that voted no and 8 or 10 representatives that voted no. Both had both sides would be able to override an entire veto of the budget. But there were, you know, parts of the budget that I think that would not have the veto proof majority. And so it's certainly his prerogative to veto as much as he desires. I hope he doesn't veto my stuff, but he certainly has that right.
Senator Rusan, I'm going to skip to Senator Newton for a second and ask you and then Senator Latvala, what the hell happened to the USF preeminence issue?
Thank you for that question. I joined the Bay Area senators in voting yes on that bill. It had some other good things in it, but when I heard the debate from Senator Young, Senator Latvala, the comments to questions from Senator Lee, I went over to one of the senators and I said, well, I'm going to vote no on this thing, but my no vote is a bookmark. It's a placeholder. Because we've got to come back and fix this. And the suggestion that was made to me was, we know we need to fix it. I've spoken to President Genshaft, and she's okay. So I called President Genshaft and spoke to her, and she said, I'm okay, let's get a date. But no one was happy, at least in the Senate that I know of, with what happened to USF. It delays something that they were working hard towards, were on a glide path to achieving. And in my questioning, I asked, was it unfair to move the goalposts on them for one reason, and that's because they award in higher proportion than FSU or UF degrees to minority students, African Americans and Hispanics. And that has somewhat slowed them down on that path to preeminence, but they've gotten good at that, and my time is up, but I did vote with the Bay Area delegation.
I agree with Senator Rusan. It shouldn't have been done. We need to fix it. That bill, though, does not take effect until next year, which gives us the opportunity of next year's legislative session to fix it without anything really being hurt. I think the important thing to remember is just in the normal course of the other programs that we did. We increased higher education funding statewide by over $500 million. That was a Senate priority. That's what we did. Out of that, USF got $57 million in new money. That's in for both operations and for facilities. That's new money, additional money, to what they would have normally gotten if we hadn't increased the funds for higher education. It's really a shame that that is lost by the fact that, you know, one thing we didn't get done right. But we're going to try to fix that next year.
Any of the state reps, would you like to weigh in on the USF preeminence issue?
No, I don't think that was said.
All right, we'll start with you, Representative Newton. Medical marijuana bill failed at the last hour. It's, again, very likely we're going to go to special session on multiple things, particularly that. The big argument is between widespread access, kind of the push by John Morgan, that we should have growers, pot shops should be more unfettered access. It seems like at the end there's the cartels as described by the Tampa Bay Times. There are 7 existing growers right now. Without getting too much into the weeds, I'm going to ask all of you, what's the solution to the medical marijuana? Oh, I know. I didn't even mean to do that. I really didn't. It's so funny. Until somebody grew around, I didn't mean to do that. What's the solution to implementing Amendment 2 through the legislature?
Well, I served on the health quality, which is the first thing we got was medical marijuana on that committee. I did the tour to Quincy, so I actually saw the cultivating shop, watched them grow it, and I saw some of the retail outlets. What we had, I thought, was a really good bill. It was a good compromise. Rodriguez had, when he came to my office and spoke with me on it, from that time to what we saw on the floor, he made a lot of accommodations. I'm talking up to the last minute. Anything that anyone may have had that wasn't fair to minorities, I think it was a good proportion in there for FAMU to do some of the testing. It was good. The hang-up was the amount of outlets. Some wanted the cap, some wanted the unlimited. That was the hang-up. We represent about 21 million people in the state of Florida. They wanted to make sure everybody had access to that medical option, vis-a-vis medical marijuana. And that's where it hung up at, that one little item about outlets versus a cap versus, I think it went from 50 to 100. And I don't know if the Senate or wanted unlimited or the Senate wanted the cap and they wanted 100. But that's where the hang-up was. But we brought in, we did our due diligence. We brought in people from California. We brought in people from Denver. They testified before the committee. We learned from what they did. We learned from what the people did that went first. And the input that we got, all that was incorporated. And I thought we had something good we can grow with. So,
which way you going? Go ahead, Representative Peters. This is still on.
You know, it really was the dispensaries were the problem. What's the solution? I'm not sure what the solution is, quite frankly. I think that I'm concerned that if we have a small cap, I think there's some justification in concerns about the monopoly, but I think that isn't the concern so much. I think it's the availability, and I think the demand is going to be so high. And I'll tell you at first, several years ago. See, I didn't
no
even
there on that one.
And actually, that comment shouldn't even be relevant here because if it's truly medical marijuana, then it's not.
Right.
And that's not the case. But since we allowed for CBD, it so happens that my physician is a prescriber of it. And so she has been educating me about the benefits. And I wasn't a big believer until she started educating me about the benefits. And so now that I've learned about the benefits, I do believe that there will be such a strong demand that I think we do need to have adequate access. And so, I'm not even going to get into the capital thing or the monopoly thing. I think we have to ensure that we have adequate access because I do believe the demand is going to be very, very high.
One more question just to Senator Latvala. You want to, all right, Senator Latvala is going to jump in on this one.
My attitude about medical marijuana or any kind of marijuana is well known. I do believe in implementing the will of the voters, and we have to do a bill. But the issue came down to the last plan from the House at 2 hours before adjournment on Friday was for 17 licenses and 100 dispensaries per license. Well, math wasn't my strong suit, but I calculated that out and I got to 1,700 dispensaries based on those caps. Well, I bet you're going to be surprised when I tell you that Walgreens in Florida only has 856 stores. So what we would have would be twice as many medical marijuana dispensaries as we have Walgreens stores who have all the prescriptions for everybody, you know? And so what's the point of that? I think 100 per license is just absolutely ridiculous, and that's all about John Morgan and the people who want to make a lot of money on this. It's not about the folks in the state of Florida.
All right, one individual question for Senator Latvala, then we'll get to your questions. Senator Latvala, there was all the budget issues. there was, it seemed like there was a distinct lack of money for transportation in Tampa Bay. Going at the TBX issue, what are we going to do to solve the major transportation problem facing the Tampa Bay area?
Well, I did do a bill that did pass, kind of revising TBARTA a little bit to try to make TBARTA a future instrument for doing more effective transit planning as a region. And we passed that. It got watered down by the efforts of Senator Brandis and Senator Lee, who are scared that someday we might have something moving in the Bay Area that has a track and wheels to it. So they got me in a position where I had to accept it being watered down to move it through Senator Lee's committee. But we still got a bill. And we've got $1 million for waterborne transportation in Pinellas County to maybe have some new options of ferries, not the one to Tampa, but the ones, in the intercoastal waterway and so forth. I think that over the next year, between now and next session, it's going to be most important to look at how the transportation funds in the Tampa Bay area are being spent. And I'm not sure how much has been reserved for the TBX project over in Tampa, but if they can't get their act together and figure out a way to spend that money effectively, then maybe we ought to bring that money to Pinellas County and use it to solve some of the problems we have over here. And I'm going to be talking about that, and that is the news that I've had to make today.
Brad Miller's going to smile. All right, let's open it up to Tiger questions. Remember, only Tigers can ask questions. Where is Sean? There she is. Mr. Jim Gillespie, let's start with you.
Jim Gillespie, my question is, do you think the power of the presiding officer in each house and 60 days to get the people's business done needs to be changed so you can really get the business done? And what changes are involved?
We'll start with Chris Lapalle, because I know what you want to weigh in on.
I do think that both presiding officers carry an awful lot of power. In the House, for instance, our parking spot, our office space, which office we have, what committees we are or are not on, where our desk is in the chamber, and what bills we filed will be heard is controlled by the presiding officer. And that was the way it was when Democrats were in charge, and that's the way it is when Republicans are in charge. So the presiding officers do carry a lot of power and a lot of weight. And I personally think that we have enough time to get the job done. We have a few months of committee meeting weeks leading up to session, and I think a lot of times those weeks aren't spent really delving into legislation and getting things moving. And as what I've seen the last few years is everything gets done or is waited on until the last couple weeks when all the horse trading goes on and each side holds bills hostage from the other side.
I think absolutely they hold a lot of power. I think 60 days is fine, and I think it depends on your legislators, and I think it depends on the leadership. So if you are a legislator that spends the entire year working on something that you think is a priority, and you do your homework and you do your research, so like when I was doing mental health and I went to all the mental health hospitals and the clinics and the forensic facilities and the prisons, I was very educated, and you can take and work and start that legislation and work with the stakeholders, and by the time you get into committees, you've got a solid plan. And you can work that through the process. So I don't think the 60 days is a problem. And I think it's up to each individual legislator. If you have one that's truly committed to their job in public service, you got your money's worth. But I think when it comes to leadership, I think when you have some leaders that are more about general's power and war and less about statesmanship, then I think you have a problem. So I think it comes to what kind of leaders are those presiding officers. And I've had the opportunity to see some really great statesmen. And then I've had some that I think that I've seen that are not so statesmanlike.
Representative Peters, when is it going? How long is it going to take before there is a female Speaker of the House?
Well, if I were going to say what I really wanted to say, it wouldn't be very politically correct. I don't know. I don't know. I know there's a woman that's going to try and run, I think, in this class. I don't know if she'll be successful. But I don't have a good answer for that.
Okay.
You know what the truth is? I think, and you're going to get a long answer on this one. I think women are different when it comes to men. And a lot of times when a woman is offered the opportunity to be a CEO or apply to be a CEO, I think a lot of times women will say, well, wait a second, I'm just not ready. And they'll think about it, and they'll contemplate it, and they'll say, I want a little more training, I want a little more education. And a lot of times you'll say to a gentleman to do this, oh, yeah, I'll do that, whether they're the training or the... I think women think of this differently. And I think women in the higher office are not educated on how the process works. So when I was a freshman, I didn't know what you had to do to be speaker. I didn't know what the relationships that you had to have and the fundraising abilities that you had to have. And I think that when we recruit people to run for office, we don't educate them on the whole thing so that they understand. And if they want to be a leader, be speaker, be president, unless we educate them in the forefront, in the very beginning, to understand what it is that it takes, and we just haven't done that with women, and women don't get together to teach each other how to do that.
Thank you for that answer. Representative Newton.
I'm sorry.
Being a freshman and observing it from a, I guess, the catbird seat, I would say, yes, they have a lot of power, and they do yield that power. You know, I asked a lot of questions in committee, and also when we were going through orientation, and I got the best parking spot. It's on the second level, right next to the vent, right next to a concrete wall. The furthest away from the tower of no power that as you can get. So I think that does yield that. But also, I want to take a quote from Senator Brandless when we were addressing the St. Pete leadership when they came up. He said, the House is more like organized. It's got a general, some lieutenants, and he said, Newt's a soldier. They just follow orders in lockstep. He said, the Senate is more like 40 Somali warlords. They're killing each other, taking hostages, and everything else. And then Representative Grant said that, well, the House is more policy, where the Senate is more monetary. And I watched firsthand how the Senate, how the House gutted the budget to almost $80 million. And then on the Senate side, they had up around $83 million in the budget. And what they would do is the House would say that the Senate would disavow their top five priority on their list if you gave them $5 billion slush fund. Whereas the House, if you offer the House $10 billion on a slush fund, to disavow their top 10 priorities, they tell you to go pound sand. So I witnessed that near the end, and when I came out after Friday and I spoke with Senator Lightbody, he said, you just witnessed the ping pong. And that's when bills go back and forth, and then they'll die on one side or the other. So that's my answer.
Senator Rousson.
Yes, the presiding officers do have a lot of power. It's one of the reasons why I have spent most of my legislative career building relationships with chairs of committees, with appropriations chairs, with the Senate president or the House speaker, because that can be valuable for your district and valuable for your values and things that you want to get accomplished. The Senate is a whole different animal, like Representative Newton said, from the House. And there are a lot of generals in the Senate. And in the Senate, Democrats are allowed to chair committees. Imagine that. And vice chair committees, which is not allowed in the House. And so that lends itself to a collegiality of operating, of working with each other. So it can be hurtful, the amount of power that they have, but it can also be helpful if you just learn to work the process.
And Senator Lightbody.
Well, I've been around Tallahassee since I went in the mid-70s as a young staff member of the Republican Party of Florida. And there were less Republicans in the House then than there are Democrats in the House now. I think we had 28 Republicans then. And so I've seen the progression. I've been a member now off and on for over 20 years. And I will tell you that this was the most dominated session by the presiding officers that I've ever seen. And I think it's a result of term limits. You know, people predicted in 92 when we passed term limits that it would give power to the lobbyists and it would give power to the staff. I think what has happened is it's given power to the presiding officers. Case in point, this year the House Speaker came out with his ridiculous bill to eliminate Visit Florida and Enterprise Florida and 16 other economic development programs. And the early days of that vote, you know, the people that were unfortunately on the committees that had to vote on it, they had to pick a side, yes or no. And I saw firsthand how members who voted the wrong way on those bills were punished. I had bills with some of them that, as a Senate sponsor, their bills stopped moving. I had appropriations with some of them that they stopped moving. And I had members from around the state, not just here in Pinellas, who came to me and asked me to take care of their appropriations because they'd been shut out of the process because they voted the wrong way. That's what it's come to in Tallahassee.
Thank you. Next question. What's it?
Time-wise, we either need to shorten their time for answers.
Let's go to 1 minute on their answers.
Okay.
Yeah. And then also, you don't have to, everybody doesn't have to answer. So, look, we love questions where you want to ask one or two people. Okay, sir.
Hi, my name is Gary Hartfield. I bring a unique perspective in that I am an ALF owner, group home owner here in Pinellas County, and I'm also a licensed 220 insurance agent. So in that regard, for group home and ALF owners, we have seen a tremendous spike in workers' comp rates. And with the reimbursement rates, it's specifically for group homes, they tend to be somewhat static. They are directly derived from the iBudget waiver. So if the revenue is static and our overhead is increasing, workers' comp rates and so forth, how do we maintain this as a viable concern, as a going concern as a business? So my question to you is, what can we do as far as workers' comp rates for healthcare services?
I'm going to go to Representative or Senator Roussan on that because you mentioned that in your opening comments. And if someone else wants to follow up.
Well, we need to reform the system, period, and be kinder to our ALF owners who are employers. I do hope that that is on the agenda when we go back for special session.
Did anybody else want to weigh in on that? Okay, next question. I'll go Susan McGrath, and then I'll go back that way. You guys were a tie.
You can choose who answers this. What solution do you see for local government to offset the dramatic loss of property tax revenue due to the increased homestead exemption and drastic effect it will have on services and public safety?
I'm going to ask our two former local elected officials, Representative Newton and Peters, to answer
that. First.
Well, first and foremost, it's a constitutional amendment. It's going to be put on the ballot, and the people will get an opportunity to decide whether they want a tax cut or not. That's what this is. Secondly, coming from 8 years local government, the people also entrust us with a tool they call millage rate. We get 10 millage points to provide service, the necessary services to them. With a successful constitutional amendment for the tax decrease on the constituency, the only other option I see the local government's going to have is for to utilize that millage to try to offset some of that. I guess the projection is about $20 million to the county, $5 million to the cities. That's just what it is. I don't know how to candy coat it any better.
Okay. I think if the voters decide that this is what they want, I think there's going to be a lot of things that happen. I think there's going to be a lot more inequalities. And the ones that I'm concerned about, because I believe it's going to be a tax swap, or for the cities and the counties, they're going to raise the utility fees, or they're going to do something to make that up. There's a lot of concerns that I have about it. The fire district, for example, fire districts I think are going to hurt the most. So in Pinellas County, I think we have to look at how you merge and make one fire district so that it's more affordable, because we already have a fire district that their millage is almost at 5 mils. We have cities that don't pay that for everything. And so for that homestead exemption, you're going to see so many people that are going to be carrying the backs of so many others. And so I think there's a lot of issues with it, and you're going to have to get creative to figure out the solutions on what to do with it. Most of it, though, I think is going to be a tax swap. I think you're going to see utility fees go up. My concern above that, and if somebody wanted to ask that, is the attack on home rule. Because if that goes through, and if egregious bills like what was presented in the House, where cities couldn't have more than 30 days in reserves, that concerns me even more. And I know I'm out of time, and if somebody wants to ask that question, that's an important one.
For the record, we voted against it.
Hold on for a second. Hold on. Senator Lafayette is going to enter in for 30 seconds. How much time do we have overall?
104.
All right, so we're going to go quickly. Senator LaFalla.
I just want to tell everybody I voted against it. I think all it is going to be we're going to redistribute the tax burden. And the people that are going to pay it are going to be people who are in mobile homes, who are in apartments, and who own businesses that have equipment, and on your rental homes and beach houses and so forth like that. They're going to collect the same amount of tax. It's just going to be different people paying it.
Please.
My name is Caroline Ludler. It might be reasonable to just address the Republicans on the panel. We just have a nice pile of money now allocated to charter schools, which are often run for the benefit of shareholders. Maybe you could explain why there is a reluctance to hold those charter schools to the same standards and mandates and oversight as public schools?
We're going to go to Chris Lappel on that question.
As the chairman of the Education Subcommittee on Innovation, I will tackle that question. I think the first thing that's important to remember is that by Florida statute, charter schools are considered public schools. So they're not just in a special category, they're considered public schools. I would argue, and I know that it's not the prevailing opinion of this audience, I would imagine, that charter schools in some instances are held to a higher standard. And by that, if a charter school is failing, they can be closed down by the school district at any point. If a public school is failing, oftentimes they get more money and more resources and they try to stay open. One of the bills that I sponsored this year, along with a couple of my colleagues in the House, was the Schools of Hope bill. And in Florida, there are 115 traditional public schools that have been failing for more than 4 years, including 8 in Pinellas County, and including some that have been failing for 12 years straight. And I'd like to talk more about that later.
Greg Wilson?
Gregory Wilson. Darrell, you should probably sit this one out, you too, Representative Wingate. It's clear that Republicans are in charge of Tallahassee now. You have a Republican governor, you have a Republican dominated House and Senate. Why can't you all be happy? My question is, was this last session an example in collegial compromise, or was it really something more akin to destructive division?
Senator Lafayette.
As the only member of the panel here that remembers what days were like when the Democrats ran things, I can tell you, and I've had the conversation already today with someone, a friend of mine, that I see a lot of the same things happening now to us that happened to them in the early 90s before we took control away from them. And the problem is with term limits and a lot of these new young people elected to the legislature, they elected the House, then they move up to the Senate. They know it all. They don't want to listen to old guys like me give them that advice. And, you know, they're just going to have to pay the consequences when the time comes.
Democrats didn't have term limits at the time.
We are going to go into lightning round very quickly. I would like to follow up on this headline, which just broke 20 minutes ago. Jack Gladwell, a month or two away from deciding on Republican bid for governor. We're not going to waste our time and ask if you are going to run for governor. Clearly you are. What is the timing?
You've always been so smart.
What is the time? What is your timing? And do you expect Governor Rick Scott to endorse you? Clearly he's not a fan of Speaker Corcoran, and he hasn't been historically close with Adam Putnam.
I do not. Governor Scott's history is that he does not get publicly involved in primaries. Even when there were primaries last year between people that support him on economic development and those that didn't, he never endorsed in those primaries. So I don't expect him, especially when he'll be on the ballot himself, I would assume. I don't expect him to get involved in the governor's race. I support his agenda. I think he recognizes that I have some of the same qualities, but a lot less money than he had when he ran. But I've made a payroll. I've paid workers' comp premiums. And I think that he recognizes the importance of that in someone that's going to be the governor. With regard to my timetable, I've been as busy as I could be the last 10 weeks while Adam Putnam was getting his thing together yesterday with the marching bands and all of that sort of stuff. I was doing the best I can in Tallahassee to get the budget done, and I found that the best way to get elected to other offices is do a good job with the one you got now.
Will we have an answer by Labor Day?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Roussan and Representative Newton, who will be your party's nominee for governor?
I believe that nomination will go to Gwen Graham.
Representative Newton?
I think it's Mayor Gilliam out of Tallahassee.
And who do you think will be your nominee for the Republican nomination? Representative Peters and, well, Chris, geez.
You go first.
What do you think will be the nominee?
Some guy named Lavelle.
I'll be casting my lot with the old timer on the other end of the table. But history has shown that people don't like front runners, and Adam Putnam has been in elected office for every day of his life since he was 22 years old. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that Floridians have the urgency to want to, just promote somebody that's a lifetime politician who, in the jobs that he's had, frankly, has done a pretty piss poor job.
Are you opposed to people getting elected to the House in their 20s? Don't answer that. Representative,
I think you should wait till you're in the ripe old age of 32 like I was.
Representative Peters.
I'm Jack.
Yes or no? Will you be voting? Start down there, Representative Black Ballot. Will you be voting yes or no on Amendment 4 now that it's been put onto the ballot?
Is that the homestead?
That's the homestead exemption.
I will be voting yes, but I don't plan to actively campaign for it.
Peters.
I will likely be voting no.
Representative Newton.
Yes.
I'm still studying.
You voted no for it, and I voted yes.
Well, it's a task to the people. I didn't stop.
All right, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being not at all transparent, 10 being very transparent, how would you rate the last 2017 session in terms of transparency? Senator Gladwell.
4 or 5. We did conduct everything that was done in a public meeting to at least make the final decisions. And, the session until we got to conference was very transparent. We involve people, we debate, we don't cut people off, at least in the Senate, from testifying and what have you. When it got to the conference process, it didn't go perfectly well, but I have assurances that that's not going to happen next year. And if it happens, I'm not going to be involved in it.
Rapid fire, Roussan, 1 to 10.
3.
Newton, 1 to 10.
5.
Representative Peters?
3.5.
And Representative Gladwell?
6.
Stay down there, Representative Gladwell. Last question, one word to describe Richard Corcoran.
Yeah! Okay, I gotta go now.
Transformative.
Strategic.
Stop.
A general.
Machiavelli.
Last word, Senator Latvala.
I'm not good.
Thank you, everyone, for being here. Thank you, all. Listening
to live coverage of today's Suncoast Tiger Bay Club luncheon from the St. Petersburg Clearwater Marriott, part of our live event coverage on RadioSt.Pete.com. Listen to this continuing series of live broadcasts of Suncoast Tiger Bay Club luncheons, the St. Pete Yacht Club, the St. Pete Clearwater Marriott, and other locations around Pinellas County. This has been a public affairs presentation of RadioSt.Pete.com.